I'd like to maybe begin this next section by talking a bit about the say jhana in the I was going to say jhana in the forest tradition, but I might back up and go back to the let's go back to the Buddha. I think one of the things that when we speak about jhana that it's a completely wholesome mental state. When the mind is in jhana, it's a completely wholesome, completely kusala, completely skillful state. So that, you know, if you've been sitting with a completely blank mind, no recollection of what happened, and don't really feel very strongly about it one way or the other, and then sort of say, ah, that must be jhana. Then it's not. when the Buddha and in the descriptions, classical description of the four jhanas, one is of course the abandoning of the hindrances, which is Ajahn Karuna Dhammo addressed, and there's an idiom that is used, withdrawn or secluded from sensual pleasures, withdrawn or secluded from unwholesome states. That's kind of your foundation or your baseline. That's your baseline. When the Buddha goes on to describe the jhanas, having abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. He makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And then the images of the bathman or bathman's apprentice kneading the sprinkling it with water, kneading it until the moisture wets the bowl, so that it's pervaded inside and out, and that's what Bhikkhu makes the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there's no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And two things that should stand out is one, how often rapture and pleasure are mentioned. This is an exceedingly pleasant state. And two, how much it is grounded in the body. This is not a... sometimes there are some descriptions of jhana you've got to drop the whole experience of the body, just kind of dissociate from the body, make it a completely mental state, and I don't pick that up from the Buddha's description. And any engaging in the pleasantness of it. It's not as if it's, because sometimes there's that sense of, I can't experience pleasure or happiness or well-being. I'm supposed to be a meditator. I'm not supposed to experience anything. But that's not how it works. This is for the mind to really settle, it has to enjoy itself, and that's it's important to give oneself that opportunity to enjoy it. Yeah.
Is jhana a subset of samadhi?
Jhana is a subset of samadhi. Samadhi is a bit more general, say firm establishing of the mind. Jhana is more like subset or a part of a continuum of experience, so that then it gets kind of described or divided off into, okay, this is first jhana, where there's, say, in this case of, okay, the initial and sustained thought.
Because I'm thinking, I wouldn't know that all samadhi is necessarily wholesome, but all jhana is wholesome.
All jhana should be wholesome in order to really be. And it's also where the Buddha makes that distinction in the Eightfold Path. There is right samma samadhi, right concentration, right samadhi, and micha samadhi, wrong concentration. So that. Wrong samadhi, wrong meditation. Yeah.
In what sense is the word seclusion being
used? Seclusion in the sense of withdrawn, pulled back from, not being a part of, so that the word is, we say, vivicha eva kamehi, vivicha akusalehi kame. So vivicha is viveka. Secluded, withdrawn, solitude, having solitude from.
It's a mental state, not a physical state.
Yes, it's definitely a mental experience in the sense of when one is withdrawing from a particular entanglement with, say, sensual pleasure or with any of the other five hindrances. So one is able to pull back from or be secluded from, in the sense that, so not entangled with. Okay? Yeah. Good. These are great questions. Neil.
Follow up on Tim's question. I assume that means that jhana does not necessarily have to arise only in seated meditation.
That's correct. There is one of the talks in this collection of Ajahn Chah's, and I won't read it. I've got it sort of marked, but I realize there's not enough time. But he is describing the development of the jhana factors in walking meditation. I mean, you're saying, okay, you're doing sitting meditation, you've cultivated this kind of stillness, this peace. At some point in time, your mind is either going to get restless or your body is going to get tired. So then change postures. And you do the same thing in walking meditation, the same cultivation of those same mental states and directing of attention, so that walking meditation is a viable entry into jhana and, say, samma samadhi, right concentration. Okay? Yeah,
Korea.
Jhana, is it only in meditation? Can it be in something?
Well, I mean, what do you mean?
Like gardening and sort of losing?
Yes. possible sports. No, I mean, you know, that's reading a book, a really interesting book. Whether it's right, say, jhana, or, you know, useful jhana, or beneficial jhana, but it's a, say, those constituents could be there. And that's where you want to say, well, what is the purpose? And that's where you start applying samma samadhi. What's its purpose? What's its function? It's like I remember when Ajahn Chah came to America, and a former monk was traveling with him, and took the opportunity to ask all sorts of questions. He'd been back in America for a couple of years and practicing in different places. And he told Ajahn Chah, he said, well, you know, I've got a friend of mine who says he didn't have to sit meditation on the cushion. He said, well, he goes into meditation and goes into concentration by rock climbing. And Ajahn Chah just laughed. He says, yeah, only for Furungs go into meditation rock climbing. Furungs is a kind of like a Westerner, sort of a white person. it's only for Furungs, just go into meditation rock climbing. And he said, he stopped me. He said, does he contemplate the Four Noble Truths while he's rock climbing? And that's a really important question, you know, in the sense of what are we doing with our meditation? Because that element of application of mind, even in terms of the first jhana factor, the vichara, is vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata, five factors of first jhana. Vitaka is the directed thought, initial thought. Vichara is evaluation. There's a certain discernment that's taking place. And that is kind of conditioning the direction that it's going in, so that evaluation and reflective quality, should have a Dhamma theme underlying it, in order to really support that. It doesn't mean that it's not wholesome. But is it really supportive of our goal? And that's where you start being able to recognize the nuances what's the purpose of doing the practice? What's its goal? Where are we directing it to? Where are we going with it? So, because sometimes it can be, immensely satisfying and energizing, but is it helping the mind to really relinquish the basis of suffering for the future? So that's an aspect of reflection that I think we should be attentive to. And even if it's not, then to recognize, okay, this is a pleasant abiding here and now. But is it? It's just a good break. But I got to get back to work sometime. Yeah.
So it doesn't have intention. If there isn't an intention, it's not useful for the goal.
No, I mean everything's got intention. I mean, in the sense of any kind. I mean, that's the basic definition of a sankhara, mental state, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. It has a volition behind it. That's why it creates. That's why it creates, the kamma and the result of kamma are the distinguishing characteristic of, say, of kamma is intention, volition, and the distinguishing feature of sankhara, like jitta sankhara, of the fourth of the five aggregates. Those mental states, mental formations, is it has a volition. Doesn't mean it's wholesome or unwholesome. It's just that's what it. We have to distinguish that. It's learning how to apply volition in a skillful way. Yeah.
I'm part of the story that we hear frequently about the Buddha when he was a child in the cattle pasture with his father. Mm-hmm. And he talks about going to a sort of a pleasant, rapturous state. Would you consider that a jhana?
I mean, that's actually, I think, what made the Buddha recollect the application of those, the skillful application of the jhana, and say he realized, oh, this path relies on that. Happiness and well-being. That's wholesome. It's without that's something that's purely, purely wholesome, purely skillful. And that's what was a catalyst for his, giving up the ascetic practices. Yeah.
Just to follow up on that. The difference between the jhana that the Buddha remembered from when he was a child and its application in the path was it his intention or capacity to reflect?
I would think so. Yeah, I mean the experience of that. I mean, what was he, 9 years old or something? When you're 20, what would he have been? You know, getting close to 35, recollecting an experience when you're 9, there's a bit of overlay there. But there's an extrapolation or a recognition. And I think the actual phrasing that he used is really salient. It's something. So he was really. That's the Mahasachika Sutta, isn't it?
That's where he's recollecting.
Yeah, I think it's the Mahasachika Sutta. Either the Satchika or Mahasachika Sutta. Okay, I considered. I recall that when my father, the Sakyan, was occupied while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual pleasure, quite secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Could that be the path to enlightenment? Then, following on that memory, came the realization. That is indeed the path to enlightenment. I thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states? I thought, I'm not afraid of that pleasure since it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states. And then I considered, it's not easy to attain that pleasure with a body so excessively emaciated. So that it's a very beautiful description of the that kind of well-being, that pleasure is you know, because sometimes but there is an innocence to it that is really important, and then sometimes the kind of the grasping after it makes it, complicates it.
I was just thinking that back to Korea's original question, first question about like gardening as an object, and it just seems to me that kind of addresses it in a sort of way, so that whatever, if you're engaged in some activity, mm-hmm. it's based on the sense of it. You know, gardening, it may or may not be. You know, but if it's something that brings you into absorption, but it's really dependent on the pleasure that comes from that sense contact of some sort, then it may not be, you know, completely wholesome, or something like gardening or artwork or something like that. It's got a wholesome theme to it that might induce a sense of pamoja or gladness that serves as a basis. But it, in and of itself, you know, it, that's what it is. It serves as a basis for uplifting the mind, and then one can move more in towards maybe a more subtle object that's not so sense-dependent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Isn't rapture and joy a sensual pleasure, though?
Not necessarily. No, not at all.
How does that work?
Well, I mean, that's exactly, you know, that, I mean, that's one of the things, with that delight, I mean, delight in Dhamma. Like one of the, say, delight in Dhamma, and just the happiness that comes from, say, from integrity, virtue, generosity, kindness. Those are joys that rapture and joy can come from, and then you reflecting on or having seen an example of real goodness. You can really, his mind can become very rapturous.
Distinguishing the cause then of the pleasure?
Yeah. That's a helpful way. I mean, if it's rapture and pleasure, you know, born of you know, a night out in wherever, fill in the blanks. I mean, that's not quite that.
It's temple.
Yeah.
There is a bodily pleasure. You know, with those states, but that was my confusion.
Right. Right.
That's kind of the result, because it's always, as Lompa was just saying, it's always a result of seclusion from, you know, the hindrances, and based on wholesome states.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things maybe the one thing that people take away from this is that you can meditate and feel. You can actually give yourself permission to enjoy the meditation. You know, that's really important, because I think we
keep doing it long, but it doesn't, you know, work.
Yeah.
Because that was my question. I meditate, pleasure arises, and I enjoy that. Does that mean that it's Dharma practice?
Again, you have to come back and investigate what's its cause, and then, because you can meditate and that pleasure arises, but the meditation, been meditating on, you know, what's for lunch next. You know?
In some cases, pleasure will arise.
Right, exactly. But there's that investigation of recognizing, okay, what's the cause? And then, what's the result? What's the feeling, tone that arises? Because sometimes, when we do experience pleasure, even if the cause is innocent, the conditioning is such that we associate pleasure with gratification. And then the mind makes that leap, and then it starts to move to find an object which it can be gratified by. This is where you really have to understand the mind, really be reflecting on that, so that there's an ability to to not get entangled with either the habits, one's own personal habits, or the habits of the world. But then also recognizing that there is a, you know, the Buddha is giving us permission to really enjoy and take delight in this practice. Yeah.
So how then are the jhana factors causal bases for awareness release into nibbana? Is it that they just diminish craving all the way down?
They diminish craving because, Ben, when the heart is satisfied, then there's a contentment that allows it to drop that which is coarser. Because if the mind goes to something that's coarse, then it stirs it up into some sort of hindrance again. The jhana factors allow the mind to become clearer. There's a clarity that arises from that. That's great. That's great stuff. Because it's, there's this kind of the nitty-gritty of it, but it's not getting speculative. And I think it's important that we see the practicality. The Buddha is giving us a very practical path of how to both foster and sustain practice. Yeah.
On the theme of the exercising, sometimes it feels like it can be used as overcoming a slot. Like if I'm up in the morning and I'm not feeling energetic, but I can go exercise and that can be wholesome.
That's the first thing I do in the morning. I don't come straight down here and do morning chanting and morning meditation. I do a whole exercise routine first before coming down.
It's possible to get attached to it and talk to people, oh, I did this, and it becomes a goal unto itself.
It can be, yeah. But, it's also... there is a... the body and mind are connected, so that when there's a certain energizing the body can enliven the mind and it goes back and forth. Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused. I read Ajahn Chah say something that happiness and unhappiness is the two end of suffering, and maybe we should aim for peace more. And so is this kind of jhana happiness different from the happiness he was talking about?
Yeah. It's a different qualitatively. It's quite different. When Ajahn Chah is talking about happiness and unhappiness being the two parts of suffering, is also and I'll do a reading from Ajahn Chah as well, but he talks about the rapture, joy, the happiness of the meditative happiness that is a support for the practice and is part of the path of the way out of suffering.
One more. So that sukha or that happiness rapture, that's still experienced as a mind object, right? I mean, you still experience it through the sense organ of the mind.
You're still experiencing it through the sense object of the mind, but it's also I want to emphasize is the grounding it in the body, because it can get very cerebral sometimes and dissociated, so that there's the way that the Buddha describes the jhana factors, that they're all the images are grounded in the body. And I think it's really important, because sometimes we're it can be taken quite cerebrally or almost theoretically, like the theory of happiness, and forget to ground it in experience, in physical experience.
So it's still a conditional thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 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 yeah.
And the rapture and joy that this being described, this is not pleasure, this is rapture and joy, right?
Well, I mean, those are just words.
Well, it's all just words.
But yeah, but it's, I mean, there's the words that are being used are piti and sukha. So that piti is a mental rapture, joyous feeling, or joyous experience. Sukha is pleasure, blissful. It's something that's experienced more physically. The commentaries give a very good distinction, illustration to show the distinction between bhiti and sukha. So that bhiti or joy is the image is of a person who is traveling in a kind of wilderness, desert type situation, experiencing discomfort and difficulty and uncertainty as to are they going to reach safety. And they come across a person who is well-dressed, they're fresh, clean, and they say, keep going, it's not very far, you'll come across an oasis, there's a forest, it's shady, there's water for both drinking and bathing, you'll get refreshed. And the feeling would be one of joy, bhiti, this excitement, rapture, okay, I'm going to go for it. And then when one arrives at the place and one actually bathes and is able to drink one's fill, eat, rest in the shade, that is sukha. That's deeply satisfying. Okay. Yeah.
Is the jhana exclusively contained those five mental states? Or is it like this is the five mental state, is the subset of all mental
states? Oh, it's not exclusive. There's many, many factors, mental factors involved, but those are the distinguishing characteristics. There's a very nice sutta of I think in Majjhima 111, the Anupada Sutta, where the Buddha describes Sariputta being able to recognize in the first jhana contact, attention, just all these mental factors, and vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata, sort of all the, and being able to experience them all one by one. And, these five factors are a distinguishing feature of the first jhana. It's not exclusively what you're going to experience, because there's memory, perception, contact, feeling, intention, So then the Buddha goes on to describe with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, so the stilling of directed thought and evaluation, stilling of vitakka and vichara, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So that they, so there's rapture and pleasure, but the first one was rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This is rapture and pleasure born of concentration. The minds come together. It's kind of unifying more solidly, and it's extremely pleasurable. And then he makes that rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade the body. So that you're still working with it. You're working with this feeling of pleasure and rapture that one's experiencing. And it's coming up, and it's like you're recycling it into the experience, into the body. And then it's becoming more and more. It's like that, the sense, I mentioned it before, fullness, this fullness that we experience, or we can experience. And then the image is just as though there were a lake whose waters welled up from below and had no inflow from east, west, north, or south, would not be replenished from time to time by showers of rain. And then the cool fount of water welling up in the lake would make the cool water drench, steep, fill, and pervade the lake, so that there would be no part of the whole lake unpervaded by cool water. So too, a bhikkhu makes the rapture and pleasure born of concentration drench, steep, fill, and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So, grounded in the body and not separated from the body. Important piece. And then there's a, and then with the fading away of rapture, so that first jhana, vitakka vichara piti sukha ekakata, so directed thought, evaluation, joy, pleasure, unification. Then second jhana, dropping of directed thought and evaluation. There's still rapture, joy, pleasure, ekagata. Third jhana is then dropping the piti. Piti can be exciting, and there's so that as the mind gets more settled, it's shedding what is coarser, and this is something that Ajahn Chah emphasizes. So that in terms of the, say, the forest practice take on the jhanas, what one is doing is letting the mind become increasingly refined and settled. And the things that stir up the mind are being shed or being relinquished or being let go of. So that they, sort of the range of sensual pleasures and reactions of aversion and restlessness and whatnot, that's all shed for the mind to settle in first jhana. Then the kind of the thinking and pondering and reflecting, and you know, that's quite satisfying on a certain level, but you start to get tired from that. So then it drops away. Because the mind is drawn to what is more sublime, more peaceful, more settling, because there's more interest in what is still and clear than what is even interesting and fascinating on an intellectual level or even on a feeling level. Yeah.
So as our practice deepens, then is it common or normal for the mind to just kind of bypass first and second jhana after a while? Like you go into a sitting and you might go straight into three or four?
If somebody is really adept, possible. I'm personally just not that adept. So, I mean,
so I've often thought in the past that these kind of four things are in one sitting, right? Like you go in the first initially and pass through. But I'm wondering if over time you just kind of drop the rhythm.
Yeah, well, yes and no. Yeah, I mean, in the sense of there are meditators or practitioners who are, you know, are really adept and they've seen it so clearly.
That they could recall them if they needed to, but their mind doesn't really want to anymore.
Yeah, because the mind goes directly to what is more still. It doesn't take long at all. So then the fading away of rapture, bhikkhu abides in equanimity, mindful and fully aware, still feeling pleasure with the body, enters upon and abides in the third jhana. On account of which the noble ones announce, he is a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. He makes the pleasure divested of rapture drench, steep, fill and pervade this body, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pleasure divested of rapture. And then the images of a lotus in the water being completely soaked by it, and simply. And then the last, fourth jhana, abandoning pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, as a purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. So that mindfulness is preceding, following, step by step with this whole process. And even the fourth jhana, which is getting extremely refined, mindfulness is the purity of mindfulness, which is the distinguishing characteristic, and due to equanimity. So these are really important distinctions, because there's a lot of confusing views and opinions about jhana meditation. So I think it's helpful to be able to, okay, what's the Buddha actually saying? How does he put it? I have a lot more faith in him than a lot of what's out there. Yeah, Kathy.
So what, obviously there is, but what's the difference between directed thought and mindfulness?
Mindfulness can be directed thought, because you can be lifting up a theme and reflecting on it, or lifting up a theme and drawing attention to it, and then the mindfulness is the actual awareness of what you're doing. Yeah.
When it says there's neither pleasant nor unpleasant,
mm-hmm.
is there also not neither pleasant nor unpleasant? In other words, neutral? Is it?
Its tone is one of of neutrality even, but it's also a neutrality that has mindfulness, so that it's not neutrality that's sort of switched off. It's a, maybe an unshakability or a real stillness within clarity.
I guess kind of partly what I'm trying to get at is that always Vedana is always described like a sense impression, right? It always has
right.
the quality of either pleasant, unpleasant or
neutral.
Neutral.
Yes.
So is trying to say is that this is kind of beyond that. That this is not something for which there is a.
No, this is this is.
Impression.
It would be.
It's only the neutral.
It's neutral because what we translate as neutral, is actually the Pali, is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So it's. I don't think there is an actual That is the term for neutral. Okay.
So the rapture and joy then has dropped away between the second and third jhana?
Rapture and joy, yeah, as bhiti, has dropped away into the third jhana. And what's left is, in the third jhana, is pleasure. Very deep pleasure. And mindfulness and equanimity. And then fourth jhana, there's an abandoning of both pleasure and pain. There's an evenness or steadiness and a neutral quality that is alert and mindful, steady. You know, which in itself is. And the image that that the Buddha gives is, say, he sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure, bright mind. So it's just brightness, clarity, kind of a brilliance of heart. And that's the... I mean, it's a very beautiful image.
Yeah. The simile. I don't think you said the simile yet of a white sheep.
Yeah. It's just as though a man was sitting, covered from head down, from the head down with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his whole body unpervaded by the white cloth. So too, a bhikkhu sits pervading this body with a pure bright mind, so that there is no part of his whole body unpervaded by the pure bright mind. So there's this. Yeah, purity and brightness, which is kind of attractive.
Question, yeah, Andy. Directed thought and evaluation and mindfulness.
Yeah.
The idea is that we are directed thought and evaluation is that we're concentrating on a certain object, right? And we're mindful of it, but that the directed thought and evaluation is it would be dropped, we would drop the object of our concentration and just abide in mindfulness.
I think it's, you know, as one continues to, to work with it, there's a, say the object becomes less important, and one comes back into the experience of it and the experiencer.
Okay.
Okay.
Nice.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, Karina.
I'm just reflecting on the language. He makes this, like, seems very active.
Yeah.
I'm trying to sense the difference. Dropping away things, is it a conscious dropping or an allowing?
I think it's similar to the image I gave of the you know, as a child, and you grow up and you give up your, you know, your blankie and your dolls and your toys that you had when you were a kid. They drop away, but it's not contrived, but there's a knowledge that's there. So, okay, I'll let that go. I can let that go. I can let that go now. Right, yeah, okay, I'll be okay.
I imagine Jeff uses kind of his words, but describes the process, I think. It's like you're still fabricating. You're still fabricating. You're still within the realm creating causes and conditions, but it's subtler and subtler and subtler all along the way. You're dropping the coarse fabrications for more subtle fabrications all along the way until you stop doing it altogether.
As opposed to something that just hits you.
Well, I mean, the reason why it hits you is because you've done it. You know, that, you know, it's not, you know, the experience doesn't arise out of nothing. Or just because you had wishful thinking at some point in time. It's because the causes have come together. And that's really with the, because there's a certain point, I mean, there's a balance that's really needed of, you know, how much we try to make it happen, how much we try to do it, and how much we try to get these states. And the more we come from that kind of, the more it just crumbles. But it isn't as if you don't, you know, you don't do anything. It's like, oh, if I just do nothing, I'll finally achieve, you know, samadhi. There is a directing of attention. There is a application of mind, but it's balance and skill. I want to do this reading because Ajahn Chah emphasizes the doing within a sphere of detachment and letting go, and it's that balance is really important, or that juxtaposition is really important. Okay, last question.
Just to follow on one of the questions earlier. So in some situations, like you're focusing on one object, right? If in that state you're aware of your pleasure, is that means that you have already left jhana? If let's say you're aware, if you know that you are feeling pleasure in the body, for example, does it mean that you already left jhana?
It depends on the degree to which one is identifying with me getting this. The experience is there, but it's a, oh, I finally got it. No, that's going to. But there's an acknowledgement. Oh, wow, that's really pleasurable. I can give myself to that. Then there's a knowledge that's there. There's a mindfulness that's there. There's a discernment that's there, but it's not glomming onto it, or it's not creating as a me.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to read from Ajahn Chah, because and I think we could take this as a a guided meditation. I think it's, I mean, it isn't in this point, but it is, I think, to let it wash over one, reflect on, let it land, and consider what and I'll read it, you know, fairly slowly, but I think it's a helpful guidance in the developing of, say, of jhana and jhana practice. Which I also have to say that Ajahn Chah, there's one of the readings that we assigned that by Ajahn Jeff, where he's talking about his teacher sort of saying, man, he rarely mentioned the word jhana in his conversations and his instructions. Ajahn Chah, very similar, very rarely, almost never talked about jhana. Because morally, what he was talking about, how do you make the mind peaceful and how do you make the mind free from suffering? That's what's really important. So. Okay. So in this practice, we must do everything with detachment. How are we to detach? We detach by seeing things clearly. know the characteristics of the body and mind as they are. We meditate in order to find peace, but in doing so, we see that which is not peaceful. This is because movement is the nature of the mind. When practicing samadhi, we fix our attention on the in-breath and out-breath at the nose tip or the upper lip. The lifting the mind to fix it is called vitakka, or lifting up. When we have thus lifted the mind and are fixed on an object, this is called vichara. Directed thought, evaluation, initial thought, sustained thought, those are two different translations for this word, vitakka and vichara. The contemplation, this is called vichara, the contemplation of the breath at the object, at the nose tip. This quality of vichara will naturally mingle with other mental sensations. And we may think that our mind is not still, that it won't calm down. But actually, this is simply the workings of vichara as it mingles with those sensations. Now, if this goes too far in the wrong direction, our mind will lose its collectedness. So then we must set up the mind afresh, lifting it up to the object of concentration with vitakka. As soon as we have thus established our attention, vichara takes over, mingling with the various mental sensations. Now, when we see this happening, our lack of understanding may lead us to wonder, why has my mind wandered? I wanted it to be still. Why isn't it still? This is practicing with attachment. Actually, the mind is simply following its nature. But we go and add on to that activity by wanting the mind to be still and thinking, why isn't it still? Aversion arises, and so we add that on to everything else, increasing our doubts, increasing our suffering, and increasing our confusion. So if there is vichara, reflecting on the various happenings within the mind in this way, we should wisely consider, the mind is simply like this. There, that's the one who knows talking, telling you to see things as they are. The mind is simply like this. We let it go at that, and the mind becomes peaceful. When it's no longer centered, we bring up vitakka once more. And shortly there is calm again. Vitakka and vichara work together like this. We use vichara to contemplate the various sensations which arise. When vichara becomes gradually more scattered, we once again lift our attention with vitakka. The important thing here is that our practice at this point must be done with detachment. Seeing the process of vichara interacting with the mental sensations, we may think that the mind is confused and become averse to this process. This is the cause right here. We aren't happy simply because we want the mind to be still. This is the cause. Wrong view. If we correct our view just a little, seeing this activity as simply the nature of mind, just this is enough to subdue the confusion. This is called letting go. Now, if we don't attach, if we practice with letting go, detachment within activity and activity within detachment. If we learn to practice like this, then vichara will naturally tend to have less to work with. If our mind ceases to be disturbed, then vichara will incline to contemplating Dhamma. Because if we don't contemplate Dhamma, the mind returns to distraction. So there is vitakka, then vichara. Vitakka, then vichara. Vitakka, then vichara. And so on. Until vichara becomes gradually more subtle. At first, vichara goes all over the place. When we understand this as simply the natural activity of the mind, it won't bother us unless we attach to it. It's like flowing water. If we get obsessed with it, asking, why does it flow? Then naturally we suffer. If we understand that the water simply flows because that's its nature, then there's no suffering. Vichara is like this. There is vitakka, then vichara, interacting with mental sensations. We can take these sensations as our object of meditation, calming the mind by noting those sensations. If we know the nature of the mind like this, then we let go, just like letting the water flow by. Vichara becomes more and more subtle. Perhaps the mind inclines to contemplating the body, or death, for instance, or some other theme of Dhamma. When the theme of contemplation is right, there will arise a feeling of well-being. What is that well-being? It is piti, rapture or bliss, delight. Piti, well-being, arises. It may manifest as goose pimples, coolness, or lightness. The mind is enwrapped. This is called piti. There is also pleasure, sukha, the coming and going of various sensations, and the state of ekagata ramana, or one-pointedness, or unification. Now, if we talk in terms of the first stage of concentration, it must be like this. Vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. So what is the second stage like? As the mind becomes progressively more subtle, vitakka and vichara become comparatively coarser, so that they are discarded, leaving only piti, sukha, and ekagata. This is something that the mind does of itself. We don't have to conjecture about it. We just know things as they are. As the mind becomes more refined, piti is eventually thrown off, leaving only sukha and ekagata. And so we take note of that. Where does piti go to? It doesn't go anywhere. It's just that the mind becomes increasingly more subtle so that it throws off those qualities that are too coarse for it. Whatever is too coarse, it throws out, and it keeps throwing off like this until it reaches the peak of subtlety, known in the books as the fourth jhana, the highest level of absorption. Here the mind has progressively discarded whatever becomes too coarse for it, until only ekagata and upeka remain. Upeka, equanimity, ekagata, one-pointedness, unification. There's nothing further. This is the limit. When the mind is developing the stages of samadhi, it must proceed in this way. But please let us understand the basics of practice. We want to make the mind still, but it won't be still. This is practicing out of desire, but we don't realize it. We have the desire for calm. The mind is already disturbed, and then we further disturb things by wanting to make it calm. This very wanting is the cause. We don't see that this wanting to calm the mind is tanha, or desire. It's just like increasing the burden. The more we desire calm, the more disturbed the mind becomes, until we just give up. We end up fighting all the time, sitting and struggling with ourselves. Why is this? Because we don't reflect back on how we have set up the mind. Know that the conditions of mind are simply the way they are. Whatever arises, just observe it. It is simply the nature of the mind. It isn't harmful, unless we don't understand its nature. It's not dangerous if we see its activity for what it is. So we practice with vitakka and vichara until the mind begins to settle down and becomes less forceful. When sensations arise, we contemplate them, we mingle with them, and come to know them. However, usually we start fighting with them, because right from the beginning, we're determined to calm the mind. As soon as we sit, the thoughts come to bother us. As soon as we set up our meditation object, our attention wanders. The mind wanders off following all the thoughts, thinking that those thoughts have come to disturb us, but actually the problem arises right here, from the very wanting to calm the mind. If we see that the mind is simply behaving according to its nature, that it naturally comes and goes like this, and if we don't get over-interested in it, we can understand that its ways are much the same as a child. Children don't know any better. They may say all kinds of things. If we understand them, we just let them talk, because children naturally talk like that. When we let go like this, we're not obsessed with the child. We can talk to our guests undisturbed while the child chatters and plays around. The mind is like this. It's not harmful unless we grab onto it and get obsessed over it. That's the real cause of trouble. When piti arises, one feels an indescribable pleasure, which only those who experience it can appreciate. Sukha, pleasure, arises, and there is also the quality of one-pointedness. There is vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, and ekagata. These five qualities all converge at one place. Even though they are different qualities, they are all collected in one place, and we can see them all there, just like so many different kinds of fruit in one bowl. Vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, and ekagata. We can see them all in one mind, all five qualities. If one were to ask, how is there vitakka? How is there vichara? How is there piti and sukha? It would be difficult to answer, but when they converge in the mind, we will see how it is for ourselves. At this point, our practice becomes somewhat special. We must have recollection and self-awareness and not lose ourselves. Know things for what they are. These are stages of meditation, the potential of the mind. Don't doubt anything with regard to the practice. Even if you sink into the earth or fly into the air or even die while sitting, don't doubt it. Whatever the qualities of the mind are, just stay with the knowing. This is our foundation. To have sati, recollection or mindfulness, and sampajanya, self-awareness, whether standing, walking, sitting, or reclining. Whatever arises, just let it be. Don't cling to it. Whether it's like or dislike, happiness or suffering, doubt or certainty, contemplate with vichara and gauge the results of those qualities. Don't try to label everything, just know it. See that all the things that arise in the mind are simply sensations. They are transient. They arise, exist, and cease. That's all there is to them. They have no self or being. They are neither us nor them. None of them are worthy of clinging to. When we see all rupa and nama, that's physicality and mentality, in this way with wisdom, then we will see the old tracks. We will see the transience of the mind, the transience of the body, the transience of happiness, suffering, love, and hate. They're all impermanent. Seeing this, the mind becomes weary. Weary of the body and mind, weary of the things that arise and cease, and their transience. When the mind becomes disenchanted, it will look for a way out of all those things. It no longer wants to be stuck in things. It sees the inadequacy of this world and the inadequacy of birth. When the mind sees like this, wherever we go, we see we see anicchan, dukkhan, and anatta. There's nothing left to hold on to. Whether we sit at the foot of a tree, on a mountaintop, or in a valley, we can hear the Buddha's teaching. All trees will seem as one. All beings will be as one. There's nothing special about any of them. They arise, exist for a while, age, and then die, all of them. We thus see the world more clearly. We see this body and mind more clearly.